You're listening to The Deceptionists. On this episode, Kelly and Dave are joined by guest panelist Jeremy Rogers as we talk about horror. This podcast is coming from inside the house. Welcome back to The Deceptionist, Truth Through Fiction. We are your fortnightly or so podcast where we attempt to bring a sense of community to that solitary act of the writer. I am Dave Ocampo, and joining me again tonight is Kelly Stevenson.
Hello.
And we have a special guest panelist tonight. He is Jeremy Rogers.
Hi there.
And Jeremy comes to us. He is a friend of mine. I've known him since about 1998. And we've written a bunch of scripts together, and we thought we'd bring him on this show because we're going to talk about horror as the first of our genres that we're going to delve into. And horror is one that we both know well. We've had a lot of conversations about horror. And for those of you who don't know, Jeremy and I put together a podcast called Wormwood, A Serialized Mystery, which was a horror podcast that ran for 3 seasons. And so we've definitely had a lot of conversations about horror, so we thought it'd be good thing to bring him on. Just to catch everyone up, the last time that we all got together, it was Paul and Caroline and I, and we talked about genre in general. We talked about what it means to write in a genre, in whatever format, but we talked a little bit about that writing in a genre, whether it's a Western or a science fiction or a romance story, it basically presents certain guideposts that can be used to manage audience expectations but it can also be a way to create stakes for you. And we talked about, I don't know if we ever came to a real conclusion or anything, but you know, we talked a little bit about it. Can it be too safe if you fall into the cliches that, you know, working in a genre gives you all these guidelines, and so in a sense you can easily fall into a cliche, and that can be dangerous too. And I think you get a lot of genre fiction that sometimes falls into that. In the end, it's something that we all love to write, and so we assign genres to everybody, and people wrote in different genres, and we actually have one tonight that was a listener, Sean Richens, I think his name is, sent to us, and so we're going to read that in a little bit and talk about what it means to horror. But I thought I'd just kick off the conversation by asking you guys what do you think of when you think of the genre horror? Kelly, let's start with you. What do you think?
Well, it's interesting because when we were talking about this podcast, Carolyn actually said that she wasn't comfortable speaking. Well, it's not fair to say she wasn't comfortable, but, you know, she wouldn't know what to contribute to a podcast about horror. And I was thinking the same thing while I was reading it. And then she said, you know, because I don't know anything about vampires. And my initial response was like, oh, right. Vampires are horror, aren't they? So I don't really know. To me, it's something that scares you. It's something that creeps you out. You know, it's got supernatural elements in it. You can't really have a horror story without a ghost or of some sort. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Can you? I mean, something like, Jeremy, you're a big fan of horror films. Something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, I would call that horror, but it's not necessarily supernatural. What is it? So what is the mark that makes that a horror film, would you say?
You know, with horror films, with any sort of horror story, it's, to me, it's all about the intensity of the fear, the emotion that comes with the fear. Whether it's fear of pain, fear of being startled, just with a jump scare, fear of the unknown, it's the dread of that fear. So with that, I think horror can be anything. Mm-hmm. whether it is a ghost or it is a guy with a chainsaw, it's not bound by anything, as long as there is that intensity of dread, that fear with it.
Kelly, do you think vampire fiction in general, do you think it's Do you think its roots are in that fear, or is it kind of spread out where now vampire fiction can be anything? It could be a romance novel, it could be a thriller, or it could be a, I don't know, a Western, I don't know.
What, like, Western you, vampires.
You're a big fan of vampires, so I'm kind of coming at it from that angle. Now, is that just a supernatural element? Can it be used? What is the fear if we want to do a vampire horror story? What would that be?
Well, I think... And this is going to completely throw us not off the horror or off the horror track. But I think people are drawn to stories about vampires because it's a compelling, all powerful, sensual creature. And there's definitely a fear element there. Even when they're gross and scary and creepy, there's still that, like, they can compel you to do things, and they, you know, they literally feed off blood. They're made of passion. They're a very good way to make something scary and creepy, they're so easy to just romanticize because of that. You know, it's somebody who stepped out of the 17th century with, you know, 17th century gentlemanly airs, but is in the modern day. I mean, it's just this wonderful romantic element, trope.
That's true. I think more than any other monster, I think vampires sort of have expanded out of the boundaries of horror. I mean, I don't see a lot of I guess some of the classic monster movies, and Jeremy, I know you're a big fan of those. You know, have a lot of pathos about the monster, the whole Frankenstein story where you sympathize with the monster. But
right.
It seems to me that vampires.
But he's not sexy.
right. That's what.
Rotting flesh, you know, zombies, swamp things. They're not sexy.
Very
ghosts
true.
Can
Very
be
true.
Sexy. You know, Patrick Swayze was a sexy ghost, but other than that,
that's a great example.
They're not really all that sexy.
So that's kind of getting. What we're kind of doing, I think, is we're kind of blowing up the whole idea that supernatural and horror are not necessarily... They go hand in hand really well together, I think, because what any sort of supernatural element represents is the other. And I think that goes back to what Jeremy was saying about fear. And that's that fear of the unknown, the fear of the other, the fear of something that's alien to us. And that could be an immortal who's lived for 1,000 years and can drain your your body of its blood, to an alien on a spacecraft, on a mining ship that is torn loose and is just hunting down the people inside. I mean, all those things can be horror, and I think it comes down to fear. But I do think that horror, kind of as a marketing term, gets lumped in with supernatural. Like, I guess I wouldn't be surprised if somebody called the Twilight movies horror, although I don't think they really are in any way.
I think they know better.
Okay, maybe they do. But I feel like, you know, it's especially when you talk about films, you know, it's very easy to just take anything that's got a supernatural element and throw it into horror. And
it's all in the tone. I mean, it really amounts to what the tone is for the project. I mean, Twilight might have vampires and werewolves in it, but the tone is completely far away from as far away from horror as you can get. I think I haven't seen it, but if you take some sort of vampire movie and your tone is to be this horrific story, something like Nosferatu, or I'm drawing a blank on another.
Even Bram Stoker's Dracula, the 90s version.
That was even a little bit of both. That romanticized it a lot, but it still played it as a horror movie. And I think it's that intensity. I think it's that. With Bram Stoker's Dracula, the movie, it was an odd mix of romanticism and gore, a lot of it. And I think that was enough of a balance between the two to make it feel unsettling enough to be a horror movie, but yet still within a certain realm to acceptable to people that don't like horror movies.
Yeah. I think what you're landing on is unsettled, intensity. These kind of adjectives are generally what horror is about. I think just as much as we love to that thrill of, you know, when the good guy kicks ass in an action film, there's something about being startled and being afraid of, you know, and that's about building intensity in a film script. In a film, you know, there's a lot of times it's the person walking through the house, and maybe the audience knows that the guy is in there somewhere, you know, but they build the intensity by having that work. It's a little different in prose, in novels. I think it is,
but there's still that moment in any format where there's that moment where you realize you're not safe. The characters are not safe. Once that moment happens, I think that's when the intensity level falls from being a thriller to being something more horrific.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good question. I mean, I was going to say Stephen King is a great example. It's in my mind of somebody that's great at creating horror, about creating that sense of dread where you have to keep turning that page, but you kind of are terrified. And usually it's about, he'll do some stories that are not supernatural at all, and he'll do some that are supernatural. But it seems to be always about that feeling of helplessness, of being trapped, mm-hmm. that fear, that intensity and fear. But what's the difference between a thriller and a horror film in your mind?
In my mind, it's, I don't know how far it's willing to go. Thinking of Silence of the Lambs, and I don't know where I would put that, if mm-hmm. that would be a thriller or a horror movie. See, with that, I think that would be a thriller, because it's. You know what? I don't know why.
You just kind of know.
Right. You're absolutely right. I agree with you.
I honestly think that supernatural element is part of it. And maybe it's not supernatural because, like, you use the example of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and if I remember correctly, there's nothing. They're just mentally depraved.
Right.
And you could make the same argument for Hannibal Lecter, but he was a real person. He was a character that you understood. Like, you never really understood why Leatherface did what he did, right?
It was for the chili.
Yeah, I mean, it was like Norman Bates. That's more of a thriller, I would think. Psycho was more of a thriller than a horror movie.
But you classically would put Psycho, I've seen, in horror film sections.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know? No, I mean, I'm not saying you guys are right or wrong. I'm actually agreeing with you. It's a really fuzzy gray area, and I don't know that there are definitions. Like you said, you just kind of feel it at a certain point. And you're absolutely right. If you're trying to get intensity and fear out of someone and you add a supernatural element, you're automatically going to be placed in the horror section.
Mm-hmm. And if there's gore, you're pretty much in horror regardless.
That's a good point. Gore. You know, it's interesting. I may misquote this badly, but I remember a while ago, a comics writer named Joe Casey did a series, I think for Dark Horse, maybe called The Milkman Murders. I remember reading an interview with him, and he was talking about trying to get horror back to the roots of revulsion, of that feeling of revulsion. And that was interesting to me because I had always thought of it as fear, and I thought the revulsion was interesting. That made more sense to me in terms of when we're talking about gore, like, you know, the just. I think it still comes down to fear in my mind, but maybe the gore is part of that. Maybe there's something grotesque. Yeah, grotesque.
There's that geek show quality to it that definitely fits. You don't have to have gore to be a horror story, and you don't have to be a horror story just because you have gore either. But they do work well together.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we could name a bunch of films that would run that gamut, too.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I mean, you could add a comedy elements to horror. I mean, Evil Dead is a horror movie, but it's a comedy. Same thing with Slither, which is pretty much Evil Dead now. It's kind of, it almost transcends, in some cases, its own genre.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think we're sort of settling on this idea that there are all these sort of conventions that you can use, but it's about, you know, elevating that level of fear. And I think the idea in any kind of writing, whether you have an audience that's viewing it or reading it, is you want to elicit some kind of emotion in them, an emotional response, an attachment. And in some ways, I think fear is just as interesting an emotion for people. Obviously, you know, horror films have stayed with us, and they've stayed with us throughout history and through history of film and books as well. I mean, they're not going anywhere. It may sometimes seem like it appeals to a fringe audience, but it's definitely always there. So I think that we do like to stimulate that fear emotion, that fear response through fiction, which is
they're
really
roller coasters.
Yeah.
It's that safe fear. It's you can be afraid, but you know, back in the back of your mind, you know, this is a book, this is a movie, this is a, you know, machine that's on tracks, and 100 people do this every hour. It's safe fear.
Yeah. Very true. Very true. Okay, so on that note, I think we should move over and we should read Sean's piece that he wrote for us, and then I want to use that to just talk a little bit more about horror now that we've established what we think about it. Sean Richens mailed this piece to us. It's a rough draft, but he did it because in the last show, we had a prompt, and we assigned genres to all of the deceptionists. And there were six prompts, but only five of us, so the one that was left over was horror. And so Sean, who's been a very vocal supporter of us on Twitter, was one of the first ones to ask. He was the first one to ask, can you assign me a genre? So we gave him horror. And then I kind of followed on Twitter as he said, oh, I have my concept. And I thought, great, let's hit him up for it and read it on the show.
Little did he know.
Little did he know. So I am going to go ahead and read this, and then we can discuss it and what it means in terms of the conversation we've had thus far. So, Sean, forgive me if I don't read it with the voice you have in mind, but we're going to give it a shot here. It's called A Familiar Taste. That'll be $280. Dan opens his eyes and looks up from his empty whiskey glass. He reaches for his wallet. He fumbles and spills coins all over the sticky floor of the bar, nearly falling to the ground as he reaches for them, due in no small part to his current boozed-up state. Dan manages to get both himself and the coins back to the bar without much of an incident. Dan's not even sure who he's trying to save face for. It's just him and the barman in the whole joint. Handing over his last bit of money for another whiskey, he slumps into the bar and begins to drink again. He glances around the dingy place. The wallpaper seems to be pulling away from the walls like a scab on a child's knee. The decoy of this shithole seems to fit Dan's mood perfectly. Placing his empty glass down once more, he reaches into his wallet, pulling out an old, slightly torn photo. Dan stares at it, and for a brief moment, he is happy. Whiskey fills the glass, and the barman catches sight of the photo. The image of a smiling little girl in black and white smiles up at him. "Cute kid, that your daughter?" Snapped back to reality, Dan stuffs the image back into the dark corner of his wallet and pushes any thought of her into even darker places in his mind. "Shut up and just fill the glass. That's why you're here." Dan spits these words at the man who has been fueling his drunken haze for as long as he can remember. The sweet nectar of Dan's sin passes his lips again. "That's your daughter, though, isn't it? I told you to shut up. It's none of your business." Dan's face twists and scowls in rage at the barman. He just smiles back. Or should I say, was your daughter? The roads were clear. It was that time of night. But still, the black Ford Escort swerved and banked. It had been going too fast, and he'd been drinking way too much. The road vanished, and an army of dark trees leapt up in front of the car. "Daddy!" The scream echoed on and on. The car only stopped when the huge oak wanted it to. Smoke billowed from the bonnet. The bar swirled back into focus. Dan's head in his hands, wet from tears. "Shut up!" he sobbed. "It's true, Dan. She's dead." Dan shakes his head, clasping his hands over his ears. "She's not dead. Not my little Summer." The barman leans in closer to Dan. He pulls his hand away from his ears and holds them tight against the bar as he whispers in his ear, "You need to accept it. You killed her, Dan." His eyes flickered open. His head pounded. Reaching up, he felt the blood running down his face. It was dark, and the car alarm was ringing out into the night like a banshee on speed. Summer sat wilting in the passenger seat. She wasn't breathing. "You shouldn't have been driving that night. You'd been drinking all day." "I wasn't drunk," Dan insisted, urging the words past his lips, as if just saying them made it so. His whole body filled with sorrow and self-pity. "Come off it, Dan. You know you were drunk. You always were back then, always will be, until you can accept it." The barman was angry. Passionate rage had come over him. Dan looks away from the barman. He closes his eyes tight, his tears falling to the ground. "She isn't dead. I tell you, she's not." The barman sighs. "We have as long as it takes, Dan." He shakes his head and lets go of Dan's hands. Dan keeps his eyes closed tight. All is black. "That'll be $280. Dan opens his eyes and looks up from his empty whiskey glass. He reaches for his wallet. He fumbles and spills coins all over the sticky floor of the bar. So thank you, Sean, for sending that piece to us. Now, I want to bring it to you guys now. I want to say, let's look at this. Is this a horror story? Very simple question. Kelly, what do you think?
I think it totally depends on what happens next. I mean, from when I was reading it at first, because he had mentioned that, you know, it didn't go quite where he expected it to go and he wasn't sure how much horror was left in it. You know, I was like, this is creepy and it's, you know, it's definitely raw and, you know, having a small daughter, the visuals were very effective. But then, yeah, the minute the bartender says, "We have as long as it takes," it was like, oh, well, this is not what I expected. Mm-hmm. So I think it all depends on what happens next.
You know, that's sure. interesting. I took this as a as the ending, in that he's trapped over and over. The ending lines, if in case it didn't come through in the reading, are the same as the beginning lines, mm-hmm. meaning that right. the scene is repeating over and over again. That, to me, is why I really, I would say that this is horror, because it's playing on that idea of being trapped in your... in this torment. You know, he did something really bad, but he can't escape from it. It goes back to that recurring motif of being trapped in something, only this yep. is being trapped in your worst moment of your
life. It has that element where you're forced to have to endure something horrible.
Right.
He's right. this yeah. this guy is stuck with this horrible event, and there's no end in sight. It's just this, it's not going to go away, and he's actually grabbed and told to confront this. And that's a horrific element, to have to face something that you don't want to.
And yeah, and I think the barman, too, interesting. He knows everything about you. So there's a fear of the other there. Is he the devil? Is he, you know, just a figment of Dan's imagination? Some sort of other entity that's making him relive this over and over again? I mean, we don't really know. And I don't think we need to know, by the way, for this particular piece.
You don't know what the intent of the
bar. No, but I want to know. I mean, sometimes, I really don't need to know, but I want to know.
Sometimes keeping you wanting to know is a good thing too, I guess, huh?
And I think that kind of keeps it more as a horror story, because you don't know if the bartender is trying to help this guy cope with this, to process this, or if he's actually tormenting this guy.
Right, he could just be helping him process it. Like, hey, we've got as long as you need. There's something a little sinister about him, though. The way
he
sort of taunts him a little bit, saying like, you know, but it is your daughter, isn't it? Isn't it? There's something that's not too friendly about that.
Yeah, but that's also the way you read it. If a therapist would say the same thing, like if they're trying to make you come to grips with something, would be like, but this is your daughter, isn't it?
True, but I think I read it that way because that's. How I feel.
That's how you wanted to read it.
No, I mean the tone and the feeling of it. I mean, I guess I did go into it knowing it's a horror story, so I guess maybe I had that in my mind.
Still, the nature of the line in context of the story feels like the bartender is prompting the guy to face this.
Right.
You know,
true.
So,
whether in his best interest or not, we don't know. Still, you know,
it's
yeah.
very Twilight Zone like, very much
yes.
so.
Yes, that yes, and the Twilight Zone's episodes, the classic Twilight Zone stories, are a great example. I mean, some of those are more sci-fi, but it's that twist. There's often a horrific element in there. You know, coming face to face with something or being trapped.
Right.
You know, and so yeah, I think this is a great draft from Sean, and it really does work towards the horror. Is there anything that you guys thought of as I read it that you thought, or at the end of it that you thought, well, this could push it further into horror? Kelly, you said you want to know what happens next, so you think if he continued this on, maybe he could push it further into horrific territory depending on where he goes with it next.
Yeah, I guess it's not exactly fair to say that I want to know what happens next, because it does feel like a complete piece to some extent. I want to know a little bit more about who the bartender is, whether the bartender is basically a good guy or a bad guy. You know, mm-hmm. if he's a figment of Dan's imagination and Dan is trapped in a psych ward somewhere, that's one thing. If Dan is actually in some sort of hell and the bartender is Satan, that's super cool and different. You know, I just want a little bit more of a tease. Yeah. I want to nudge in the right direction.
Yeah. Jeremy, anything that you thought as I was reading it or after the end of it?
No, it's a really good story. I do like the fact that it comes around full circle in the end.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I would say, and I don't want to rewrite anything, but if he killed his daughter by driving drunk and he's sitting in the bar drinking, and the bartender is continually filling his glass up, there seems to be something there you could use as a means for grief for the guy. I mean, would this guy want to drink to drink away the misery, or would he have an issue with drinking because of what it led to?
Yeah.
It seems like there's an element there with alcohol that could be used for something.
Yeah. Yeah. It even occurred to me that this could even be a sort of a ghost story, like from the ghost point of view. This is him reliving or being, you know, how ghosts, they often an element of a ghost story is that you can't escape, that they're repeating the same actions
right.
over and over again. You know, maybe he had, you know, died and he's in this, whether it's limbo or an actual bar or something, and he's
right.
just repeating the same events over and over again.
That's the bar he's in before he goes and drives his daughter somewhere.
Ooh, yeah, I like that. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's, to some extent, what Kelly was saying is like a little bit more could actually make it even creepier and push it further. I almost thought that, I don't know if I want something longer necessarily in terms of the linear narrative, but something in that scene with the bar, I almost, and maybe this is wish fulfillment, Kelly, because of the way I read it, but I kind of almost wanted the barman to be a little more sinister. Like, I wanted some element where we felt like Dan can't get up or, like, he can't go anywhere. I thought that that could actually push the, because right now he's drinking in the bar over and over again, but there's nothing to say he can walk out. He can't walk out. But what's happening is every time he starts to do anything, he just thinks about the little girl, you know, so he's kind of keeping himself
everything
there.
Does still seem to be his choice.
Right, right. And so that's really interesting. And I'd wonder what would happen if Sean wrote, like, Dan trying to leave or doing, I mean, is it himself? Is it, and I don't know if, I even want the answer to this. I just, you know, that if I were Sean, that's what I would see. Mm-hmm. If I were going to give Sean advice, that's what I would say, is I'd play with that and see if you can make that feeling of being just trapped there and being forced to face that over and over again.
Right.
He's got to keep opening the wallet to see the photo, to be reminded, you know, until he can get over it or get past it, I guess. And I think that's very effective.
Absolutely. And one thing it uses, and it's a great device for horror stories, is the idea of loss. You know, horror and loss and sadness and all that, it works really, really well together. Mm-hmm. And I like the melancholy, sorrowful horror stories, and this definitely has that.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. So we've talked a lot about what we think about horror. Let's talk a little bit about writing horror. And thank you again, Sean, for sharing that with us. I hope that was helpful. But I want to talk a little bit about, you know, writing horror and what we do if we approach it. Kelly, have you ever tried to write a story with the intent, even if it's not a horror story in your mind, where you're going for a scare in something you've written?
I'm trying to think. I know that I've definitely, one of my nano novels is about vampires and werewolves, and it's set sort of in the modern world. And I was actually going back through it today in prep for this podcast. And there's the moment where the main character realizes she's surrounded by supernatural beings. And it needed to be scary because it's from her, you know, the story is mostly told from her perspective. And so I didn't so much write with the intent to scare the audience, but to communicate how scared the character was. And hopefully some of that leads over into the audience.
I think that's fair. Yeah. Anytime the character, you want them to feel nervous or scared, you're hoping that you'll elicit that emotion, I guess, in the audience. You know, that
right. You
don't
just want to say, Penelope was scared.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
You kind of want to explain why she's scared, like what she's seeing, and then her reactions.
What kind of things did you do to not say Penelope was scared, but to actually show things that might scare her, I guess?
Well, The biggest challenge that I have, and this is, I think, a challenge, it's a frustrating thing that happens anytime I read a story where people just, they're not aware that they live in a world with these creatures. Like, we all know, if you say zombie, granted, none of us have ever actually seen a zombie. If a zombie walked into any one of our rooms, we'd be like, holy fuck, that's a zombie. And, you know, you'd blow their head off and run away. Like, we know what to do because we've seen enough of this stuff. But yet, when you get into a book or a movie and suddenly nobody knows what that creature is, it's like, come on, man. Like, you've read the books too. You know that this is a creature. And so there was a challenge to not start the book off with, like, by the way, this guy's totally a vampire, but you can't let it drag on forever because it's so obvious he's a vampire, like, if you're reading the books. And so she's at this party, and it's a Halloween party, so everyone is dressed up in sort of vaguely sinister looking, and the, like, the party's kind of creepy in an Eyes Wide Shut sort of way, not sexy but just creepy. Mm-hmm. And so it's already got that she's completely out of her element, and everything is not sort of what it seems. And then there's a moment where one of the women sort of reveals herself as a vampire. She transforms into a monster. And so I didn't say, you know, she turned into a vampire. But I did have to challenge myself to describe what was happening to her. You know, like, she gets fangs grow out of her mouth without, I didn't want to use the word fangs. Mm-hmm. Because again, there's all these, like, hot button words. So I started with basically her not understanding what she's seeing and trying to sort of make sense of what's going on around her. Because I do feel like, well, if a zombie walked into the room, I would realize that's a zombie, but there would be this complete moment of shock because there's a zombie.
We are in an interesting place in pop culture where everyone knows all these tropes, and yet when you create a zombie movie, you almost have to start over and pretend it's a world where people don't understand that there are zombie movies. I guess when I think of that immediately, what I think of is the film series Scream, which was, you know, the first really self-aware slasher film that was this sort of metafictional take on, okay, now these people have grown up on horror movies and they understand the rules, so, you know, and they still manage to create, you know, a scary movie while being aware that all the characters knew what scary movies were all about. And I'm trying to think if other zombie movies or vampire movies have done that in more recent years, but
there's Shaun of the Dead did to an extent.
Did it? I was thinking about that one too, and I thought, I remember them like screaming a lot, but I don't remember them going like, oh, those are zombies from movies, what do we do? I don't remember that so much.
They were kind of nonplussed about the whole thing, but I think that was part of the movie.
Well, there was that, right.
You know, in it's Zombieland, isn't it?
Yes.
The one with Woody Harrelson and the non-Michael Cera, Michael Cera.
Eisenberg, yeah. Jesse Eisenberg. Yeah.
And I think they knew, I mean, well, it starts off as part of the zombie attack, but they were pretty, you know, these are zombies. Here's how you deal with them.
Yeah. But I think that's a great point, is to get to horror, to get to that fear we're talking about, it's a lot of that unknown. And so you're very wise in basically trying to describe what it would look like if somebody started to transform in front of you. Because even though you know films and everything like that, it would probably still be really freaky if your friend came in and suddenly started growing fingernails and teeth and, you know, or shifting in some way that was inhuman. You know, it would really still freak us out. And so I think that's kind of one of the things you have to do when you're going into horror. You know, you have to really think about it in those terms of what are the images that are scary, what can you put your character into a situation, and kind of, to me, it's the visuals are a lot of it. You know, I think about what images scare me, and so even if it is a vampiric image or something like that, I try to think about what's the scariest aspect of that. You know, I just watched a film, Insidious, recently, which was a pretty decent film, actually, pretty decent scary movie. And there's a part where a character is talking about a dream she had where there's this creepy man standing over this child's bed while he's sleeping. He's actually in a coma, you know, but it's just this shadowy figure, and they do that sort of thing where the camera pans over and you see this shadow in the corner of the room, and the hand reaches out and it's these long talon-like fingers. And I don't care if I've seen that a million times, that's scary as fucking hell when I see that, you know. So I like stuff like that, but I also think that, like, the tense moments where the character feels trapped. I remember that French film, High Tension. I can't remember what the French title, but that's more of a slasher type of film. But there's a scene where the girl's in the little bedroom upstairs, and she's gotta hide under the bed while the guy really slowly walks through. Incredible amount of tension built in that moment, and you're just sitting there, your heart pounding, waiting to see, like, is he gonna do it? Is he not? And you know, horror films know that. They know that, you know, you're waiting for it to happen, and so it's all about timing and throwing you off of when the scare is going to come. You know, we've all seen the thing where the bathroom cabinet is open and then they close it again and there's something in the mirror, and now people have to, like, do more to that because that's not good enough anymore because everyone is expecting it there. You got to throw it off again, and, you know.
Okay, no, but the mirror thing will always get me. Like,
it can still
work. I don't even like thinking about mirror tricks, and, like, maybe it's because I have a poor peripheral vision, but that whole corner of the eye, you turn your head and something moves behind you. Oh, I hate it so much. I don't, as much as I like vampires, and I do like reading things that are suspenseful, and I love what Moffat's doing with Doctor Who, all the creepy elements of that. Mm-hmm. Like, actual, I'm trying to make you jump horror films, they get on my nerves.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, because it like you're talking about, like, you know, the girl hiding under the bed, you know, at some point something scary is going to happen, and the whole crowd is going to scream and jump and yelp. And so I just, when I'm in those theaters, I just close my eyes and wait for the moment to pass, and then I open them, because it's almost not fun to me how much it startles.
Yeah. Another effective one that I just thought of for me a couple years ago was when that first Paranormal Activity film came out in the theaters. Because the setup of it was that, okay, something's happening at night, so we're going to set up a camera at night. And so what happens, you'd be waiting and you're like, oh, it's getting dark, they're going to go to bed. They get into bed, they set up the camera, it switches to that single view of the room, and then you're sitting there watching it, and you're watching and you're waiting. I mean, that's a very effective. They've got you on the edge of your seat. You're looking at that screen for something to appear on there, you know, and it's just about
the anticipation is killer.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And something that movie did that a lot of movies don't do anymore, and they used to back in the 70s more, I think, is horror movies need to establish the geography of their locations. Mm-hmm. You need to be familiar with the surroundings, I think, to notice something's different. To notice, you know,
that's a good point, yeah.
To know where you can go. And Paranormal Activity did that with that one simple shot. You got so used to seeing that one image, you knew the geography of the house.
Right.
You know, things like Halloween would do that too. They orientated you to the neighborhood, to the houses. You were familiar with the landscape.
Yeah.
When movies don't do that and it's just this endless chase, it's this, doesn't matter what's on the other side of the door. It's you don't know.
Right.
So it could be anything. The fact that a new movie, you know, like Paranormal Activity, established a location was really impressive to me.
Yeah.
You don't see it anymore. You used to a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I think of Poltergeist, and I think there's a point towards the end they're running down the hall, and the hall just starts stretching.
Because
when you have that location and that familiarity, and then you can start twisting things, and it really messes you up.
Exactly. Then you notice when something's off.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Well, Jeremy, you've written a lot of horror. I mean, you and I wrote a bunch. What do you, when you sit down to write horror, what are you thinking? First of all, do you sit down trying to scare? I know we had a lot of conversations about how do we make this scary? And this was, you know, we had a set of hurdles because we were dealing with an audio-only thing. But when you sit down, just in any format, whatever you want to talk about, when you sit down and you want to write horror, what kind of – how do you start? Do you start with a creature or something, or do you start with a fear? Like, this is the fear I want to do, like the fear of public speaking, and then you come up with something that's a horrific version of that, or
right.
You know, like what do you start with?
Generally, I'll start with the character and what the character needs. Most of the horror stuff I've written has really been for Wormwood, and a lot of that was based on characters needing something and going to really bizarre lengths to attain that. So I think the drive of somebody who is willing to push too far, regardless of how that affects other people, I think that's fairly scary. Mm-hmm. Being controlled by somebody who is willing to break all sorts of limits to get what they want, regardless of how that affects you, that's kind of how I lean towards that uncomfortable horror vibe. And so
that almost the I can't even speak right now. The protagonist driving the horror in that sense? Not just that it comes from the character, but I mean, it's the him going too far that puts him into uncharted territory?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, I don't really do the monsters so much. I mean, I love the movies and the books and so on, but I don't really write that so much. So it's all about human limits and how they're different for everybody, and that can be pretty scary if somebody goes way beyond yours,
right. But what about the other type of so that's a protagonist going further, going past the limits. What about if your protagonist is afraid of something and you want to play to that fear? You want to put them in a situation where they're going to be. Just you want to make the. Have you ever written that way where you're thinking like, how can I make the audience feel really uncomfortable here? by tightening up, you know, the environment, the situation, the threat imposed upon the protagonist. Because a lot of a lot of what I think of when I think of classic horrors, I think, you know, let's say Rosemary's Baby. You know, she's got this thing growing inside her, but she's starting to fear these people that are all around her. And then it's about ratcheting up that tension where it gets worse and worse, and she can't trust anybody, and she's just not sure if she's going mad or not. So she's not really driving past certain limits. It's all about this external threat.
How do you
approach that external threat?
Yeah, you know, I'm not really sure. First off, if I can make somebody uncomfortable, whether it's a character or the reader, perfect, and that's always a big goal. I don't know. If you can make somebody feel trapped, if you make somebody feel helpless, and make them realize that they're probably not going to get away unharmed, that's a lot of fear, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's the key, too. I'm trying to think in my own writing, and I don't know if I've always been successful. When we were writing, I think when I write short stories and stuff, I don't necessarily go for the horror. I like supernatural and creepy elements, and maybe I'm trying to create that, but I'm not really thinking, will this scare someone? I'm just thinking what appeals to me, and I think I am attracted to that sort of fear of alien or unknown things and mysteries about that. So I tend to write a little bit more into the mystery than anything, but I know there were times when we were writing that series that I thought, like, this needs to be scarier. What can I do? And I remember in one specific case, you know, since it was all audio, I decided to just have a character tell a story and tell a story about some people that were trapped and the sounds that they might hear. And I was really trying to – so in a way, that's almost like a prose story because it's someone narrating it, someone telling it. And they were just trying to tell this, you know, tell this story and get people to really – in this case, it was getting the audience, but also the person that he was telling the story to in the show, you know, to try and feel that sense of tension, of that sense of being trapped. I guess that's what it really all comes down to, is that element of danger,
helplessness, you know, and danger.
You know, we know that fight or flight response. I think that's what's really ingrained in us. And if there's something overpowering that we know we can't fight, then it's all about flight. And if you start closing off the exits,
sure,
you know, the tension and anxiety grows. And I think that's, you know, when you're sitting down to write something, I think I go back to what I said earlier about Stephen King being great at that, whether he is doing it with supernatural elements or non-supernatural elements. It tends to be about just creating these unsavory situations and characters and ratcheting up that tension and taking away the exits. And you really, you want to make the audience feel like there's no way out, there's no way out. And then you drop the floor out, you know, or something happens where you give them an out finally, you know. And that's really effective. If you get tense, and you turn that page and you're like, oh, and you take a breath. And I think in longer forms, you have to give that a little bit of the wave back and forth of building and then giving them a little bit of break.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's interesting because I think it's a lot harder to do in prose. If you're writing a script for, I would imagine, even an audio show, because you've still got two sort of tracks there, it's like in order to scare someone, you have to distract them. And then throw something else in that they didn't notice, you know, whether it's you're staring at the room and you're staring and you're staring and you're staring and it's actually a sound that triggers that startles you into noticing something, which you can't really, like, there's no waiting when you're reading because you're still reading. You can't stare at the same three words. You can't tell the audience, you know, in the book, now look at the sentence. Now look at the sentence again. It's harder to do in prose. And I think we're getting close to it. I think it's definitely, you have to make the person empathize with the character and then play on that character's fear.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, when I think about books that I read that scared me silly, it was the Stephen King I read as a teen. It was It. It was Pennywise.
Well, that
the clown.
I mean, come on.
and again, this is long before, you know, Tim Curry ever donned that makeup for the kind of bad TV movie. But this was scary in its own right, and there were the voices coming, the sewer voices coming from the you know, drains and stuff, and the we all float down here. And there's something where you get that image and that sound in your mind, and he does a great job of building that and then, you know, just running with it, and you can't escape that, you know.
The great thing with prose, you can't really do the jump scares so much in that,
right?
But you've already got a voice in the reader's head when they're reading it.
That's true.
It's popping up in their head. You're exactly where you want to be. I mean, you're in their mind. And if you could control your pacing, if you can control kind of how the reader is going through the words by just deliberately writing in a way that you're interpreting that they're going to kind of play it in their head the best you can, you're already there. Yeah. So you can be unnerving and unsettling because they're hearing that as they're going through the pages. And I think that's a big help.
Yeah, that's true. There's no closing your eyes in a book either. I mean, you can either stop reading, but if you want to know what happens, you got to keep reading. A movie, you can look away at the crucial moment and then look back again when it's over, right?
Yeah, but the book is internal.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
So, exactly.
No, so it's very much you have to create that. You know, I've talked about this before about fiction being about creating a continuous dream. You don't want to take the reader out of it. You want to create a continuous fictional dream that just carries them along, and you can carry them into some very terrifying places. So it's just about that. It's about building up those walls, building up that room, putting the person in there, and then you've got full control over where you're going to take them. You're right, though. You can't do the jump scares. You can't do the classic tactic of, you know, I remember hearing horror directors talk about how you throw something from the right side of the screen in, because people tend to look at the screen left to right because we're used to reading. You know, so you throw something from the right towards the left, and it startles people more. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a film technique, you know, and that's something you can't do in a book. But in the book, yeah, it's what Kelly said. It's like you've got to just get a hold of them and just take them in there. And then, like you said, Jeremy, you're there with that character, and they have to follow that character through. So you really, it's all about just trying to create fear in that character, fear of shadows, fear of what's there, you know, fear of the footsteps in the hall, whatever it is, you know, really build on that.
Yeah.
We do have a listener question from Weekly Roll on Twitter, who said, how do you write that big scare moment you would normally see in a movie? Now, that's an interesting phrasing, because he says you would normally see in a movie. So I'm not sure if he's saying, like, as a screenwriter, how do you write it for the director to do it? Or is he saying, like, how would you get that big scare, but in like, comics or in prose? Is he saying, like, a different medium? I'm not really sure. I would say, you know, for a film, you know, it's kind of, you write it in the same way that we're talking about writing prose. You build the situation. It's up to the director if he's going to have the cat jump from this point or that point, and it's about music, and it's about performances, and it's about the shot itself. So there's so much that's out of the hands of the writer. So if you're asking, like, how would a screenwriter write it, I think you just have to do that. You just have to create that tense situation, and then have, you know, the vampire appear behind him at that moment, and that's all.
Right.
That's all you can do.
But as a screenwriter, you get to cheat. Like, you get to, you know, put that little synopsis at the beginning of the scene that describes the elements, and you can just say eerie music.
Right.
You
know,
or the girl looks around and is very scared. Like, it's not saying that screenwriting is easy by any stretch of any imagination, but you know, in some ways, you can cut a lot of that.
Oh yeah, yeah, and Kelly, you're absolutely right. The thing is, it's a collaborative film, is a collaborative medium. So even if you put eerie music here, the director could decide that, you know, calliope music, carnival music, whatever is what's fitting right there. You know, it's not even up to the screenwriter most of the time.
I know a lot of horror movies, especially a lot of independent horror movies, slasher movies in particular, don't have very long scripts at all. They're very basic, down to just the dialogue, and the action's not really described, because they wait to see what locations they scout and what they're going to use, or where they're going to be filming the stuff, and then they go back and they will design the script around their locations.
Good point. Good point. See where you're actually shooting, and then kind of build the scares from that. So that's a great point.
Especially with, like, a stalk and slash sort of movie, location is crucial, and the writer has no idea where it's going to be filmed. So a lot of times that's left fairly blank. It's not uncommon to see, like, a 60-page horror script.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's one way to interpret that question. I don't know what he had in mind here, but if it was, you know, how do you get that big scare moment in a different medium, I would say, you know, we've kind of talked about that you can't create the same kind of scare, but we talked about it, is you just build that tension, and then when the door opens and then there's someone there, or they run the other way and then there's someone there, it's just about, you have to just describe it in that very careful way, where you're controlling the pacing, even to the way you write your sentences and how descriptive you are, how short or long your sentences are, create that pacing and that tension, and you drop your character right into that and get them, I think, honestly, as close to the terrifying thing as you possibly can. You know, get the vampire's teeth right up on them, you know, and that's how you create the moment where that person might put down the book because they have to stop reading it for a minute, or you know, or they got to ride it on through. And comics also.
Or they skip three pages.
Yeah, or skip three pages. I think comics are interesting. We haven't really talked about comics yet. I remember Mike Mignola, the creator of Hellboy, talking about how you can't really do scares in a comic the way you can in a film, because, you know, it's the person turning the page at their own pace, and all you can do is, you know, put the pictures down. So you can't really have, like, you turn the page and, oh, somebody's breaking through the door right now. You know, it doesn't have that same kind of scare.
It's a different kind of scare. You can scare with ideas.
It's closer to prose probably, but it's different. He said that you kind of build a sense of creepiness and atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And I don't think Mignola really goes for scares so much, if you notice.
No.
And so his stuff is arguably not even horror. I mean, I think it is, because it's sort of creepy and otherly, and it does play on that fear of, you know, this strange and otherworldly, but you don't really often feel afraid when reading a Hellboy or Hellboy related story.
True.
And I can't think of any comics that really like truly scared me. You know, make me feel tense. Sure. Yeah. Like I got to turn the page, something like The Walking Dead, you know, it wasn't so much about when the zombie's going to burst through,
right.
But about, you know, how are they going to get out of this situation? Oh my God. I can't believe that just happened to that character, you know, stuff like
but
that.
But at the same time, it's about zombies. So by default, it's a horror, you know, it's like American Vampire it's got a few scary-ish moments in it.
Yeah.
But it's about a bunch of vampires, Western vampires, actually. So by definition.
Series Lock and Key does a pretty good job of kind of playing like a cross between a book and a movie. I think the way it plays out the stories with some more supernatural scares is pretty well done in a comic book.
Yeah, yeah. And they did a great – I don't know if you're current on that series, but there was a story that where they're trapped. Some of the characters are trapped in a location where the water is rising. Uh-huh. So that was a nice tension building. They got to get out of that situation, but you know, like they can't get out, and so that's a nice way that they built tension over a classically paced comic book story. I'll be curious to see. You know, that's being developed as a pilot, and if it does go to series, I'll be curious to see if they're able to play scares in that more than the comic, because I don't know if the comic, you're right, it's a good balance, but I'm not sure I would ever say it certainly doesn't have any sort of jump scares, and I wonder if they'll...
No, it doesn't, but the first collection of stories, the first storyline was pretty much a horror-based story with them being stalked like that. Curious about the TV show. I read that it might not get picked up.
I read that too. Yeah, I'm hoping it does. I think it could be really great, and I'm just curious if they'll be able to utilize some of the film and TV scares that we've been talking about more than the book is able to take advantage of, just because it's a different medium.
Right.
So, okay. Well, you know, I think we've really kind of covered all the bases. And do you guys have anything else you want to mention about horror as a genre?
Please don't write scary things about mirrors.
About mirrors. So no mirrors. You've never seen that movie Candyman, then, I take it, huh?
I don't think so. Did you
see that Kiefer Sutherland movie called Mirrors?
Oh, I didn't see that one.
No. If it's got mirrors in the title, I'm not going anywhere near it. But like even like The Ring, where she comes out of it, it's just creepy stuff happening in the background. If it's a picture or a mirror, it's just not cool at all. at all.
All right. Well, we're going to continue after horror. We're going to continue on our next set of shows. We're going to cover different genres, and we're going to have some different guests on, like Jeremy tonight. So, Jeremy, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, absolutely. A lot of fun.
And so we're going to talk about science fiction and romance and fantasy. And I forget what else I don't know what else I'm forgetting, but
Western, you
know, Western
crime.
That's the other big one. Yeah. We're going to talk about different genres and delve into them just the way we did here. So stay tuned for those shows coming to you over the next few weeks and months. And does anybody want to talk about what we're working on? Kelly, are you working on anything right now that you want to share?
No.
You have a prompt due, if I'm not mistaken.
Right? I've been pretty bogged down with work for the past month or so, and that's why I haven't actually been on a podcast in a little bit. But yesterday while I was doing chores, I actually tried to get caught up on some of the podcasts that I missed and listened to Paul's wonderful music prompt from two podcasts ago. And then actually while I was listening to the follow-up show, the one that was about genre, when the three of you started talking about what the music meant to you, it was like, I have to stop what I'm doing and write down my idea and get it started before I listen anymore, because it was driving me crazy. Like I could like feel what you were saying shape what I wanted to write, and it was
absolutely
like, let's stop. I started working on that, but that's it. Yeah, and I'm fantasy, right?
Yes.
Because whatever it was too easy.
I know. We drew them. We had talked about assigning genres to people, but we ended up drawing them out of a hat. And so you got genre, but the prompt is, it's two people meeting in a bar. And you have to do a fantasy story based around that. I actually drew sci-fi, so I started working on, and I'm kind of playing a little, you guys will laugh when you see what I did with my, but I actually have a concept for the sci-fi bar prompt, and that one's going to be a little fun. And then out of the blue, I wrote, I started thinking about, well, what would I do if it was fantasy, even though it's not my assigned genre? And I ended up writing this story that was just going to be like this cute little like 300 word thing. And it's, and I started just really falling in love. I basically wrote a fairy tale, and it was a fairy tailor, a fairy tale about a tailor and a knight in a bar. But I really love just like creating this world and the voice. I'm doing very much a fairy tale voice, and I just had so much fun. It was one of those few short stories that just sort of dropped into my lap, and I just was writing very smoothly, and you know, with no pauses. And I have no idea if it's any good or if it's just silliness, but I had so much fun that even though it's not my prompt, I may have to post it at some point on the Deceptionist site just to share it with you guys, because it really was fun. And then aside from that, I've been working with Jeremy on, we just revised a science fiction script we've been working on. So that's been a tough revision as we, and I think I mentioned this on a previous show that, you know, the great thing about having a co-writer, now I actually have Jeremy on, we can, you know, mention it, is that, you know, it makes you prove everything that you're working on. Like,
right.
You know, if you guys come at it, if to your co-writer, if you two, I mean, first of all, you got to respect each other and you know, respect each other's judgment. That's crucial. If you do have that, you'll still have points where you guys are coming at it from slightly different angles, and you'll have to sit there and argue out and figure it out. But in the end, that thing is bulletproof, you know?
Oh, absolutely. It's so much stronger because of that.
You know, I guess it's maybe like having an editor, but it's like, you know, but it's different because you both have something at stake in it, you know, in the actual writing of it. Yeah. So it's been wild, but I'm very happy with the script we've worked on. So
we have
that. And Jeremy, do you have anything else you want to share with anybody, anything you're working on right now?
Well, besides the comics, which have been taking up some time, I'm back to working on my book, which has been a fairly new thing. I wrote this last month or last November, and I put it aside for a while, and I didn't want to look at it. And I went back to it recently and was nervous to start reading through the pages, and I'm okay with it. So I'm back to working on that.
So you did Nano for the first time.
I did it last year. And yeah. My goal was to do the first draft in November, put it aside for December, and come back to it in January.
And so now it's May.
I'm back on it now, and you know it's I can work with this, so I'm back on that. And along with that, I'm working on a screenplay that's sort of overflow from the book.
Oh, nice. So you've got a lot of projects. Like you and I were the same. We've got like we're not happy unless we have at least three things we're trying to write. And then it's like, oh, but now I'm going to write a fairy tale just because
right.
I feel like it.
Exactly.
You guys like have day jobs, right?
Yes. Yeah. Well,
and
look,
families like don't you have a daughter?
I've got a son. He's got a son. Yeah.
My goodness, must be nice.
It's very difficult. And when I say that, I mean, look, I wrote a Nano novel that I'm supposed to be rewriting, and I wrote that 2 years ago, and I haven't still got. I maybe rewrote the first 10 chapters, and that's about it. So,
yeah.
I mean, I've struggled. When I say we're doing all this stuff, I mean a lot of it is we'll you know it'll take a while to get things done because we'll be working on too many projects, and
also
frankly,
things
we'll drop.
You know, some things take the forefront. You know, it was the comic books for a while, and we did nothing but that for a little bit. Got that to a good point, and then you can move on to something else.
Yeah, it really is whatever your muse wants you to do that day.
Very true. I mean, I put away the sci-fi story and immediately, like I said, just dropped on that fairy tale just because it occurred to me in the car while driving. I'm like, oh, that would be cute. And then I started writing. I'm like, oh, this is really fun. You know? Kelly, tell the people about our website.
Our website is thedeceptionist.org. It is a sexy WordPress blog where you can download our show. You can interact with us. You can talk to other people. We should put up a writing prompt somehow connected to this while I'm babbling. You can reach us at contact@thedeceptionist.org if you have any comments or questions you'd like to share with us.
Yeah, and please comment, people. And really, again, I want to thank Sean especially for being a listener who gave us his story to read on the show, and I hope more people will do that. You know, we are doing these genre prompts right now, and so anytime you guys want to send us a prompt, I mean, I can't always say that we'll read it on the show because we've got to read our own at some point. points. Horror, we didn't have one, but we, with your permission, we could also post it up on the website for people to take a look at and see what you got out of two people meeting in a bar and whatever your chosen genre was. Because we've had at least three people ask for us to assign them a genre as part of this experiment on Twitter. So,
which is really cool. I want to build like some just app that we can put on the site that's like, here's your genre, go. Here's your scenario. Go.
There's got to be some way to do that, like a random genre generate.
I almost called it a genre generator.
I just call it a generator. Genre-nator. So yeah, and so our Twitter is I can't speak. Ah, it's been a long day. At Deceptionists, right?
Yes.
Twitter.com/Deceptionists. So friend us on Deceptionists and follow us along or send us notes about how we're doing. And I think that's it for our show. We'll be back next time. I'm not sure what genre we're doing next, so you're going to have to be surprised about that, but it'll be one of the aforementioned, and we'll have another guest on. And
thanks so much for joining us, Jeremy.
Oh, this was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Yeah. All right, folks. I think that's it. I'm Dave.
I'm Kelly.
I'm Jeremy.
And we'll see you all next time.